This is Christoph Kisun, and you're listening to Navigating Diversity, where we explore how human beings differ, yet can find ways to relate to one another in an increasingly xenophobic socio-political climate. Our intention at Navigating Diversity is to have open, honest, and informed conversations that can help people navigate some of the most important issues of diversity we are facing globally today, but in a way that isn't afraid to ask some of the big questions, the big, sometimes heavy questions, that can bring some of the light and hope into the conversation and help give this and all of our lives meaning. At Navigating Diversity, we emphasize three core values. First, recognizing the duality in all things, holding space for both the light and the dark, or differences and or similarities, the things that scare us and the things that make us feel whole, for neither can exist without the other. Second, vulnerability, finding more conscious ways to stand in our truth and help others to stand in theirs, and to share our stories and the most authentic parts of ourselves with the rest of humanity as the only way to heal the world. And third, perhaps our most important value, get comfortable with being uncomfortable. It's the only way for us to grow and to do better. Navigating Diversity airs on Tuesday nights at 7:30 p.m. on KISU, and you can catch all our conversations at kisu.org/programs/navigatingdiversity. You can also find us on Facebook to stay connected and keep the conversation going. Simply search the handle @diversityradio. Today, I'm very excited to be joined by Scott Greaves, host of KISU programs MindTap and Sustainable Idaho. Scott is a master's student in biology at Idaho State. Hi, Scott.
Thanks for having me. It's scary to be on the other end of the mic.
It's interesting, right? Yeah. You just did it. You just interviewed me on your show, MindTap.
Yeah,
so we're doing a little collaboration within KISU.
Now I'm on the scary side.
You're going to do great.
Oh, I hope so.
So, Scott, I only met you recently, right? It was probably like a few months ago. We kind of just bounced in the studio.
Yeah, exactly. Just sort of asking, what are you doing for your story this week, and what am I doing? And yeah.
So I really don't know too much about you.
So I'll give a bit of background then.
So let's start with where you're from.
Yeah, so I'm from England. I'm from Norfolk, which is on the east coast of England, and it's pretty rural out there. And yeah, I grew up there, went to the local high school, the local primary school, which is sort of like the elementary school here.
Yep, I love that. This is perfect because I'm from the British Caribbean, so we use primary and secondary school.
Oh, really? So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I stayed super local. I even went to university to do my undergraduate at the nearby Norwich University. So I really was like a local town boy, studied climate change.
Okay, so your undergrad is in climate change.
Yeah, exactly. I studied there, and then I thought, you know what, I've got to get out and see the world. So I went and started studying marine biology in Florida, and then I transferred here to Idaho State. So that's like the 10-second summary of my life.
So you came to ISU to do your master's.
Yeah, exactly. So I can tell you. Well, I'll give you the long version now.
Okay.
I'm a runner. I do a lot of running. And I did a race one day, and I qualified to run at the Olympic trials in 2016. After I qualified to do that, my email blew up with lots of emails from different universities in America saying, would you like to come and run for us? And to start with, I thought it was a scam. I didn't realize that they would pay me to come and run for their team. But I did a bit of research and found out that it wasn't a scam. It was actually real. And so I decided that I was going to go for it. And I accepted an offer to Nova Southeastern University, which is in near Fort Lauderdale in Florida.
Mm.
And I just upped and left for America. And
wow.
That's the story.
So you came on an athletic scholarship.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, okay. Exactly. It was back in 2015, so it's 5 years ago now. I basically, I was coming down the home straight and I was looking at the clock And I just like couldn't believe it, and this time popped up, and then that just like changed my whole life basically.
Wow.
Because I went from being sort of like a nobody in athletics to getting to go to the Olympic trials and getting treated like a real runner, and getting all these opportunities to come here. So that was really crazy.
That's
yeah.
amazing. it's so funny how life just presents you with these opportunities and you just do things you never knew you were capable of, and
yeah,
then everything
I mean,
changes.
I knew I really wanted to do a master's degree after getting my undergraduate. I knew, you know, I found out that I was really interested in science and that I wanted to keep it going, but it's really expensive to get a degree, turns out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like everyone else, I was like getting into debt, getting my undergraduate, and I thought, you know, I'd love to do more, but it's a tricky decision because it's so expensive.
Definitely.
In England, we pay £9,000 a year for a degree, which is about, I don't know, $12,000 a year for a degree. So it's pretty comparable to sort of like a state university, I would say.
Uh-huh.
And I knew that it was going to be a tricky decision to, if I was going to carry on in England. And then when this opportunity popped up and I could get one on a scholarship, then I thought, well, yeah, this sounds like a great idea.
Follow the money 100%.
Well, yeah. And
that's
also
how I ended up here too.
What an adventure as well. I mean,
yeah.
It's like, not many people get to, you know, live in a different country, and it's such a privilege to do that. So
did the majority of people you went to high school with and primary school, did they pretty much stay in Europe, in the UK?
Yeah, I mean, I live in a tiny little village called Reefham. Probably has about 400 or 500 residents.
Wow.
And a lot of my friends who I grew up with in Reefham have never left Reefham. You know, there's nothing wrong with that at all. You know, it's something to be said for a sense of community and really a sense of belonging. But I knew I wanted to get out and see.
You wanted some exposure.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, within a few weeks of getting to Florida, it was crazy. I mean, as soon as I got to Florida, Hurricane Irma hit. This
wow.
was 2017. So I'd been there for a few weeks, got hit by this hurricane. We lost all our power. I remember I was foraging for sticks to make a fire so
oh
I could cook
God.
Some food. And I was like, this is not what I thought America was going to be like. But yeah, I mean, what an adventure it was. Amazing.
Wow. How does small town life in England compare to small town life in America?
Like I say, when I first got to America, when I was in, you know, very close to Miami, it was not small town life
right.
at all. And
it was a whole new world for you.
Oh, yeah. I was, you know, we've just been talking about diversity, and I was thrown into probably one of the most diverse places in America, in that there's a huge Cuban, huge Haitian population there. There's all sorts of different people that I got to meet, and that was, I loved that. It was so, so fantastic to be able to sort of broaden my own horizons.
Mm.
But I didn't get on very well with the fact that it was, you know, it's almost like city living. I'm
right.
definitely more of a rural person.
The ease of living in a small town,
yeah,
it's
the
calm.
Slow pace. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided that perhaps this isn't for me, and I needed to get back to some of that sort of, not so much a slower pace of life, but something that I was perhaps more comfortable with. There was a great opportunity to do some research up here, so I jumped on that and came and decided to move to Idaho State. I don't know, small town life in England is, oh, you go down to the pub in the evening and you sort of, you know, everyone down there. And
right.
It's very different to here. I think there's perhaps less of a sense of community amongst residents here, but there's much more of a sense of like a university community, you know, with the different sports that go on. There's no such thing as, you know, university sports in England. Nobody follows the,
right.
the university sports teams there. Community is a very different thing. I think in England, it's very much about, you know, where you live and how you interact with your neighbours and that sort of stuff. Whereas here, it's definitely built around different structures like the university.
That makes a lot of sense, yeah. So I don't know if you know Florence and the Machine.
Yep.
Yeah, so they're like one of my favourite bands ever. So how you're describing growing up in a small town in England is very much aligning with how Florence describes in her lyrics.
Oh, yeah.
Growing up, yeah.
It's very much, you go to the pub, you know, the culture of it is... I think it's quite lovely, actually, living out in the countryside. There's a lot of farms.
It's beautiful.
And it's very slow. And yeah, I mean, I think I'm going to end up living back in England, I imagine, after I graduate.
Yeah.
I'm not sure yet, but it just, there's something about it which I really enjoy.
Do you feel like nostalgic for it?
Yeah, I'm talking about it.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about you being an international student. Is it hard for you being away from your family?
Yeah, I mean, especially during COVID right now, it's, well, the first thing to say is that we're 7 hours different here than what we are in England. So if you want to communicate or talk with your family and friends, then you have to make sure you do it earlier on in the day, because by 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, everyone's asleep.
Right.
So, you know, being an international student is great because you are opened up to all these new opportunities, this whole different way of living, and that is just fantastic. But the worst bit about it, without a shadow of a doubt, is being away from your family, your friends, and maintaining connections with your friends is actually a really hard thing to do, especially when, like me, I've been away for three, you know, this is now my fourth year here. It's tough to keep your friends because you don't see them very often. I'll go back at Christmas for a few weeks and sometimes in the summer, and you know, you see all these people and it's fantastic, but then you know you're going to be leaving again for 6-7 months. I'm sure you've experienced this, but staying in contact with your family and friends is not so much your family, you try and speak to your mum all the time, but
yes,
but your friends is really, really tricky.
100%. So I call it two world syndrome. It's like living in two worlds. Mm-hmm. You kind of always have one foot in and one foot out wherever you are.
Yeah, you feel like you live, yeah, you do almost live two lives. You have your life in America and your life back home. And the longer you're in America, the harder it is to see where you came from almost. You're slowly losing your connections to...
You're assimilating.
You are. America is like sucking you in and talking about all the amazing things that it has to offer.
I couldn't agree more.
I mean, it's a really tricky thing to try and make sure that you, I don't know, you don't lose where you came from, but at the same time, trying to maximize the
opportunity.
Yeah, the opportunity.
And kind of lean into your life here, because, you know, it is a blessing that we get to do this and be here. I mean, particularly in COVID-19, I have dreamt my family in Trinidad every night for the past month. Vivid, vivid dreams of my grandmother's house and my parents and the food. And it's almost like in my dreams, I'm spending time with them.
Because you probably won't get to go home for Christmas, right?
No. My border is closed. Yeah, the border of my country is closed.
Yeah.
So when I see people complaining about things like wearing a mask, I'm like, oof. There's much worse things, trust me.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like I can go home, but getting back to America is very,
tricky.
Very difficult, because I'm going to be sort of transitioning onto the optional practical training visa
OPT.
program, which is basically like an extension of your student visa to be allowed to work in the field that you've graduated
in. Yeah, for like a year, right?
Yeah, for a year. And but they do recommend that you don't go home during that time, because there can be difficulties getting back in. You know, even though you have a legal status, there can be difficulties getting back into the country. And you know, something like that is tough to deal with, because it's like, you know, you've put a lot of effort in and you've spent a lot of money to try and get yourself into a position where you're allowed to work and actually feel like you can give something back to American society that's already, you know, given you a lot by actually offering a degree program and scholarships and all these opportunities. You want an opportunity to actually say, you know, these are my skills and I can contribute to American society in this way.
Right.
But if you leave and you want to, you could actually not be able to get back into the country. And that is
scary.
That is scary.
Yeah.
Even over the summer, I had lots of problems trying to get back into the country because of the travel bans. And, you know, that takes a toll. Like, that's tough to try and deal with. And it makes you want to almost give up trying to do what I'm doing here, which is try and, you know, use the skills that I've learned to try and apply them to a job. But
you'd just rather not take the risk. And I think that takes a toll on your mental health too.
Yeah, I mean, on the program I've been working on, Mindset, we talk all the time about different mental health challenges. And it's one of the things we've learned is that mental health is very specific to everyone, and everyone, you know, faces these different challenges. And for international students, the worries about visas and
immigration and
is absolutely very real.
It's nightmarish.
It is nightmarish.
And most people, like, when they look at international students, they just think it's easy, and they think they don't see the hot dog factory all they get is the hot dog and the casing in the grocery store. But if they actually knew what we had to go through to make this whole thing stand, they'd be devastated.
Yeah, I think that there's an interesting relationship between international students and the American population in that I think sometimes we're seen in a negative light because we're coming here, often we're taking athletic scholarships. I know there'll be people listening to this who'll be hearing me telling my story about coming here and taking, you know, an American's scholarship.
Right, which I can
understand. You know, a lot of American undergraduates are paying into a system where there are opportunities for international people to come and take these scholarships. But I don't necessarily see it in that way, of course. But, you know, I think it's diversity in that bringing different people in and gaining a different perspective has, you know, a range of benefits for
the whole society.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Not just an athletics team or, you know, bringing in talent from elsewhere. I think there is wider benefits to the system. But, you know, I understand why there's sometimes a bit of animosity between
the locals and the foreigners.
Yeah, definitely. It's a tricky thing to try and justify sometimes how that system works. Like I say, that's almost why I feel obligated to try and
contribute.
Try and give something back to. I often find myself saying something like, oh, this would only happen in America and it's in a bad light. And then I find myself thinking, well, it's so bad. Why am I here? And then I remind myself that there are so many like brilliant things that are offered by this country.
Absolutely. It's such a complicated relationship.
It really is.
If you're just joining us, this is Christoph Kassoun and you're listening to Navigating Diversity. I'm here with guest Scott Greaves and we are navigating some of the big questions that help give this and all of our lives meaning. So Scott, let's switch gears a little bit. So Navigating Diversity has definitely taken on somewhat of a spiritual focus. What is your definition of spirituality?
Well, I grew up having absolutely no mention of religion, which I think to a lot of people listening here, they'll probably be like, you know, it's pretty hard to avoid in an area like Pocatello. But I truly never considered my spirituality as a child or even like a young adult. I really did not. I went to a school where not a single person I went to school with was religious in any way or not that I was aware of. It was never talked about at home. And it wasn't because it was avoided. It was simply because it just, where I grew up, it just was not a topic of consideration.
So fascinating.
And my view is that I've done a degree in climate change. I've just completed a degree in biology, and I feel a very deep connection to the earth. And I've been really lucky to like study a lot of different components of the earth system and how it works and plants and nature. That is where my spirituality comes from, is my connection with the earth, in that I feel that it's just so beautiful and so intricate that it's something that we need to respect and look after and really act as a human population. We need to be a steward towards the planet. But religious consideration was never something that I grew up even really thinking about or talking about at all.
In your town, there was no like major dominant...
Well, no. I mean, in England, we still have really beautiful churches all over the place in England, but most of them are falling out of use because there's very few people now that will attend. It's been fascinating to come here and learn about like the different religious beliefs and how strongly people feel about that. I think that's what's been so striking
like
for me.
It governs their life and their choices.
Yeah, whereas for me, it's really not been a consideration. It's almost been... I almost see that as a strength for me, because now when I hear different people's religious beliefs, I don't have any inherent bias.
You're like a blank state.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people grow up in the religion with a level of spirituality that's not so much pushed on them, but it's the environment in which they grew up. They're a product of their environment. And whether or not that's good or bad, I don't know, but it's... that seems to be how it is, whereas I never had that. So it's, you know, if I want to adopt my own approach towards religion or spirituality, I'm able to do that because I don't have any backdrop to it whatsoever.
Right. You can put in the work and decide for yourself, like what works for you, what doesn't work for you.
Exactly.
What do you think is true?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know, you know, if that's good or bad that I didn't have any real religious education growing up. I mean, we did, in schools, we did learn about religion. Mm-hmm. But it was very much from the perspective of people in this country think this and people in this country think this. It wasn't ever
we
about...
We think this, so yeah. You need to think this too.
Yeah, it wasn't ever about that.
Wow. That's really, really, really fascinating. So you are really passionate about the environment and climate change, and humanity is not doing a pretty good job right now. What do we need to be doing if we want to start taking care of the environment more?
When it comes to environmental stewardship, there's really like two avenues of thought you can go down. It's either individual responsibility, or it comes down to sort of governmental and corporate responsibility. And for me, I think that as individuals, particularly in America, a lot of people have the means to make more sustainable choices. Mm-hmm. And that means when they're choosing a vehicle, they can choose a vehicle that's more environmentally friendly. They might be able to make decisions with their diet that actually would impact their carbon footprint. Mm-hmm. I often struggle with the fact I've traveled on an airplane probably more than most people. So I'm very cautious of telling other people what to do, but I've even donated to carbon offset groups to like offset my footprint from traveling on an airplane. So I really think there is a level of individual responsibility that people can take, but we also need to recognize as a society that we have a crisis coming. And that if we want to avoid that crisis, and that crisis isn't just climate, it's also biodiversity crisis. We're losing so many species. And if we want to avoid that, and there are real reasons why that is terrible just in itself, but it's also going to have knock-on implications for human societies. The ecosystem and the services that they provide to human, you know, that's what regulates our air, our water,
you know. It's a very delicate, fragile system.
It's the ecosystem services that manage the productivity of our soils for the food we eat. So these are real decisions that are going to impact everybody in the near future if it isn't already. There are great, even documentaries on YouTube, like David Attenborough's A Life on Our Earth. If you watch that, there are some fantastic tips in that as to how you can take a level of individual responsibility. And your vote is one of the most important things you have as well. You know, if you're choosing someone to represent you who doesn't have the environmental views that you want to see perpetuated,
or even believe that climate change is real.
Exactly. I mean, that's a huge issue. I mean, that's one of the things you come to America and you find that people don't believe in climate change. You don't hear that anywhere else.
Yeah. And everywhere outside of America, it is not a political conversation.
No.
It's just a basic fact and everybody agrees climate change is real.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting. There's some great research being done actually in the biology department at ISU that's shown that people who don't believe in the term climate change, because it's a politically charged term, do believe in a lot of the consequences of climate change. So I think really, when we get down to it, the vast, vast, vast majority of people do believe in climate change and do understand the facts. It's just, it becomes a politically charged term, which is something we need to avoid.
Absolutely. So you talked about, you know, being a good steward to the environment as being your sort of spiritual practice. So do you think part of the reason why the environment has become so deteriorated in the condition that it is right now is because our spirituality as a species has deteriorated?
Possibly. I think we've just become disconnected from the environment. Now, you consider how many people live in cities and what opportunities those people have to experience nature, and what actually drives the decisions that we make is nearly always some sort of economic decision-making process. Whereas we have to consider that actually there are important factors that lie outside of economic markets, for instance. You know, if we want to really dig down into what's important to us as a species, we do have to look beyond
money.
And a lot of people's like spiritual consciousness is going to be driven by money, you know. That's the major driving force in their life. And there's a really tricky conversation to be had, because a lot of the countries in which we need to do really important conservation work, they're also very, very poor countries. Mm-hmm. So there is this trade-off between, you know, we really, really want to protect these lands, but we also understand that if you were to exploit them, there is a level of poverty alleviation that would occur.
Absolutely. I mean, it'd pretty much just be doing what the Western industrialized countries did.
Have already done.
Exactly. And now the Western industrialized countries shame developing countries.
Yeah, even though we've already benefited from the exact same thing.
Exactly.
So it's a really tricky conversation. And that's why I think we have to look beyond these sort of terms like this country first, mm-hmm. because this is a global issue, and mm-hmm. we're only going to do it, you know, make meaningful progress towards environmental stewardship if we work sort of internationally. And that means 100%. That we have to have this, I don't know if you would call it spirituality or awareness, that
just a basic common understanding of the interconnectedness of every living thing.
Mm. And I think being a scientist studying in these sort of areas, I think what frustrates a lot of people is that the science exists. The science really does exist on a lot of these topics here. Where can we target our resources to maximize the protection of ecosystems? Where, you know, what forces are driving climate change? We know these things, but it is really now down to the will. And that, I think that does come down to the sort of the collective spirituality of the human population. What can we do to really drive the consciousness in a certain direction that is sustainable? It's a really, really tricky conversation to be had.
Why do you think we've gotten to this point where we're so disconnected from each other and from the planet?
I do think it's just how, or what things we're told are important, and what things our society suggests are important. There are some things which really, really strange. We have a society where sometimes it's shown to be really, really beneficial to work loads and loads and loads. And, you know, that's seen as like a great thing you can do. Whereas you think about like what you want in your life, you know, can't be many people who look back and say, well, I'm really glad I work 70 hours
exactly
a week. It's almost like we have a society that sort of puts forward these strange goals for us.
That are so just unnatural.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
For like what a human species needs, yeah.
Yes. I did an interview on Mindtap with Diana Yoop, who's a Native American person who also is very influential in communicating indigenous and tribal cultures. You know, you think about that group, they were able to manage resources in a sustainable way
for generations.
Yeah, and a lot of the messages that they put out, we would sort of consider to be very, very strange. You know, they value very different things to what we value, but it was much more sustainable than the practices we are.
100%, and a lot closer in alignment with what a human being is.
Mm, definitely. Mm-hmm. And it's not to say that like everything we're doing in Western society is bad and is destroying the environment, but there are changes. And I think these changes will come in as we see more crises. That is what really drives human innovation. You know, you consider the amount of innovation that happens during wartime when there's a real crisis. This is what we're facing an environmental war coming up. And so that is what is going to really, really drive human innovation, because we are a brilliant species. We, you know, we have a lot of ingenuity. And we will solve the issue, but it's a matter of how soon can we get it to become crucially important. It's, you know, you consider like the COVID vaccine.
Yes, yes, yes.
Everyone was saying, well, it takes years and years and years to get a COVID vaccine. Well, you get a crisis, and then here it is. Here's the vaccine.
We love a deadline.
Oh, yeah. Love a deadline. Exactly.
Yeah. No, I completely agree with you. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And do we want, as a society, to be proactive and start trying to minimize the impact of what is coming? Or do we want to wait until that deadline is pushed up against us?
Exactly. Yeah, and the scary thing about that deadline is the emissions we put out now and the damage we do now are to some degree irreversible. You know, you think about carbon emissions, you put carbon in the atmosphere, it's going to be there for 30, 40, 50 years beyond. So it's what we do now is affecting the future. So the really scary thing about this is we can't see the deadline. That's the kicker with this issue.
It's a moving target.
It really is, in that, you know, what we do now is affecting future generations in a way which we don't necessarily acknowledge or see, but it is there. And we do understand scientifically that that is the case, but it's conveying that urgency, which is really the key challenge.
So how would you try to get somebody to understand that this is a global human problem, that no matter what we do, the only way out is together?
Well, I think that the issue of sustainability and global management is something that we are able to recognize in the crises that are happening. That's what we can see. Really, what is scary about it is that those people in impoverished countries, developing countries, are going to be affected by it much worse than those in developed countries.
Even though they contributed the least to the problem.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Even though they contributed the least, because they have the least capacity for adaptation and therefore their level of resilience is lower.
Right.
So, you know, it's a level of empathy. It's like we have been talking about today before we started this show about diversity and mental health. Mm. It really is about having a level of empathy and concern and understanding that our actions are affecting other people. It's the same as COVID and not wearing a mask.
Yeah,
it's not about just you getting sick. It's about you making other
people
sick.
Right.
Yeah. And so exact same issue here. And what also makes it difficult, because it's such a big issue, it's this collective responsibility that actually makes it challenging to sort of promote action, because people say, well, so-and-so's not doing it, or why should I be the one to make the sacrifice? Whereas with, you know, an issue like COVID, it's different, because it's, you might have COVID or you might give COVID to one other person, and it's much more observable and measurable.
Right.
Whereas with a big issue that's sort of happening in the background, like environmental crises and climate crises, because it happens in the background, it's much more difficult to see. And so we really need to see, instead of ourselves as individuals and individual countries, we really need to think bigger, because this is a bigger issue that's happening in the background, and have empathy and understanding and compassion for those who are less fortunate than us and are going to be affected much more so than we are.
So this is how I put it to one of my friends this year. If you don't care about the most random stranger out there in the world, why should they ever care about you?
100%. And you would like to think that if you were one of those people in one of these countries that are going to be really negatively affected by climate change and climate crises and extreme weather events that are going to happen as a result, you would like to think that people who have the power to do something are going to.
Right,
and that's the position that every one of us is in. The vast majority of us have the opportunity to do small positive things. And I think people also find that it adds a level of, and will make them feel good about themselves, because they are doing something positive for other people. And that's
hardwired into who we are. Service, that's what like keeps us going.
Absolutely. There's now an emerging branch of science which is really getting to link the social and political components of this issue with the hardcore science of the issue.
Absolutely. We need a bridge.
Yeah, and this bridge is definitely growing. I did my master's thesis on ecosystem services, which are basically the benefits that nature give to people.
Ooh.
So it's at this sort of coalition between the sort of core sciences and the human side of this issue. So
very cool. I think it's important work, and I think you're right. I think more and more of us are going to be taking on that mantle, because we have to start bridging these two worlds. Thank you, Scott.
No problem.
This
Thanks for having me.
Fantastic. Yeah, and good luck with everything coming for you in the future.
Yeah, and I should do a quick plug for MindTap. So
please.
We are on Friday mornings at 7:35 a.m. And also Sustainable Idaho, which I've been helping with recently, is also available on Tuesdays at 7:35 in the morning.
Beautiful. Okay, thanks, Scott.
No problem. Thank you.
This is Christoph Kisun, and you've been listening to Navigating Diversity. Scott Greaves has been helping us navigate some of the big questions that help give all of this and all of our lives meaning. Join us next week at 7:30 p.m. on Tuesday as we continue to explore how human beings differ, yet can find ways to relate to one another in an increasingly xenophobic socio-political climate. For more information on all episodes, visit kisu.org/programs/navigatingdiversity. And you can follow us on Facebook. Simply search the handle @DiversityRadio.